Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, and as always at this time of week, I'm about to bring you our reflection on the Sunday Gospel, which will be followed by Joan Knows. Joan Lewis brings us a rundown of the Vatican week. Let's begin then with Jill Bevilacqua's There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye. Stay tuned for the reading of the Gospel by Sean Patrick Lovett.
Jesus called the 12 together and said to them, "You know how among the Gentiles those who seem to exercise authority lord it over them. Their great ones make their importance felt. It cannot be like that with you. Anyone among you who aspires to greatness must serve the rest. Whoever wants to rank first among you must serve the needs of all. The Son of Man has not come to be served, but to serve, to give his life in ransom for the many."
It was only very recently that the gospel of the day was all about being important, being first, and how Jesus told the apostles that if anyone wishes to rank first, he must remain the last one of all and the servant of all. And yet here we are again on the same theme. The brothers whom Jesus had nicknamed Sons of Thunder, James and John, have asked him to allow them to sit one on his right hand and one on his left when he comes into his glory. It seems that the message has still not been received, or at least not understood. And the strange thing is that on both these occasions, Jesus has just been talking again of his passion and death. It's as if they don't want to hear about the prelude to his glory. And at any rate, they still cling to the idea of a temporal kind of glory. What Jesus says about wanting to be first is not a condemnation of this desire, which is part of human nature, writes Father Raniero Cantalamessa, the Pope's preacher.
Not only does Jesus not forbid it, he encourages it. Only he reveals a new, different way of achieving it, not at the expense of others, but to their advantage. In fact, he adds, "May he be the last of all and the servant of all." The way up has become the way down. The last of the series may well be the first. It depends where you start from.
Misunderstanding the gospel meaning, the 19th century German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche believed that Jesus favoured the slothful, the renunciatory spirit. Comments Father Raniero.
He felt duty-bound to fight Christianity, which in his view had introduced into the world the cancer of humility and renunciation. He opposed the gospel values with those of the will to power embodied in the Superman, who wishes to raise himself up, not lower himself.
Of a different opinion was the French writer Antoine de Saint-Exupéry, author of The Little Prince.
Humility did not cast down the individual, it raised him up. It made clear to him his role as ambassador, the messenger of God, or the path taken by God. It forced him to forget himself in order that he might wax and grow, for if the individual exults in his own importance, the path is transformed into a sea.
And what are the fruits of the two ways of being first, asks Father Raniero.
The will to power leads to a situation in which one dominates and the others serve. One becomes happy, if there can be happiness in this. The others unhappy. One alone comes out the winner. All the others are defeated. One dominates, the others are dominated. In service, on the other hand, the situation is reversed. All benefit from the greatness of one. He who is great in service is great himself and makes others great. Instead of raising himself above others, he raises others up with him.
In his poem Prometheus Unbound, Shelley, who was avowedly atheist, yet exalted the greatness of Christian values and contested the apparent omnipotence of power.
To suffer woes which hope thinks infinite, to forgive wrongs darker than death or night, to defy power which seems omnipotent, to love and bear, to hope till hope creates from its own wreck the thing it contemplates, neither to change, nor falter, nor repent. This, like thy glory, Titan, is to be good, great, and joyous, beautiful, and free. This is alone life, joy, empire, and victory.
We are told in Luke's Gospel of an occasion when our Lord was invited to dine at the house of a ruler who was a Pharisee, and of a parable he told as he watched the various guests choosing the places of honour.
He said this: when someone invites you to a wedding feast, do not take your seat in the place of honour. A more distinguished person than you may have been invited, and the person who invited you both may come and say, "Give up your place to this man." And then, to your embarrassment, you would have to go and take the lowest place. Now, when you are a guest, make your way to the lowest place and sit there, so that when your host comes, he may say, "My friend, move up higher." In that way, everyone with you at the table will see you honored, for everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and the man who humbles himself will be exalted.
The celebrated phrase Jesus pronounced also in the parable of the Pharisee and the publican, and the concept of the great ones of the earth being put down from their high positions while the lowly are exalted, is echoed also in Mary's Magnificat. The natural desire to rise in the world is usually accompanied by the illusion that on achieving a high position, a person will then be free to do as he or she pleases. But, as the essayist Francis Bacon wrote back in the early 17th century,
"Men in great places are thrice servants, servants of the sovereign or state, servants of fame, and servants of business. So as they have no freedom, neither in their persons, nor in their actions, nor in their times."
And he adds a warning note:
"All rising to great place is by a winding stair."
But perhaps the most celebrated lines on greatness are those from Shakespeare's Twelfth Night, in the letter supposedly written by the Lady Olivia to her foolish steward Malvolio, who believes she is in love with him.
"Be not afraid of greatness. Some men are born great, some achieve greatness, and some have greatness thrust upon them."
Somehow, the last kind of greatness reminded me of the hapless Pope Celestine V, who in 1294 was practically dragged from his hermitage in Calabria to become Pope. Writes Geoffrey Barraclough in The Medieval Papacy:
"There was a lively belief that Celestine would restore the reign of poverty and re-establish Christianity in its pure evangelical form. What happened, of course, was different. Celestine had no experience of practical affairs. He could not stand up to pressure. He was unable to cope with the vast machine that church government had become. And after only a few weeks, he abdicated."
Elsewhere, we read that, in fact, he reigned for 4 or 5 months, during which time he managed to create 8 French cardinals, before being hounded into retirement, as another writer puts it. The 80-year-old Celestine was then locked up in a fortress by his successor, Boniface VIII, so as to prevent his enemies exploiting the ingenuousness of the former hermit. And there poor Celestine died, only 2 years afterwards. He was buried in a monastery, but his body was removed 30 years later to the church of Colle Maggio in the town of L'Aquila, where a tomb was built for him. He was canonized by Clement V in 1313, but achieved a different kind of fame when Dante referred to him in his Inferno as he that made the great refusal out of cowardice. But as later scholars testified, it was not Celestine who refused the papal crown, but a Cardinal Orsini, unwilling to follow him. In 1970, Pope Paul VI made a pilgrimage to the fortress where Celestine had died to pay homage to his memory. It's often been rumoured that Paul VI thought long before he accepted his election to the papacy. Did Hamlet, as he was so often called, have something of a fellow feeling for his predecessor of long ago? Greatness has been written of by many different kinds of men. The 19th-century American essayist Emerson wrote, "Great men are they who see that spiritual is stronger than any material force, that thoughts rule the world." And a great friend of his, the Scotsman Thomas Carlyle, wrote,
"No great man lives in vain. The history of the world is but the biography of great men. Great men are the inspired, speaking and acting, texts of that divine book of revelations, whereof a chapter is completed from epoch to epoch, and by some named history."
We might challenge Carlyle's definition of history as a divine book of revelations, without going so far as Henry Ford's famous declaration, "History is bunk." But let's take a look now at what the poets have to say on the subject. This verse from Longfellow's Psalm of Life has often been quoted, especially the last line.
"Lives of great men all remind us we can make our lives sublime, and departing leave behind us footprints on the sands of time."
And now let's listen to the first and last stanzas of a poem by Stephen Spender, who died in 1995. Spender was always thought of as a poet of the 1930s, but his last collection of poems, Dolphins, he published the year before his death, on his 85th birthday.
"I think continually of those who were truly great, who from the womb remembered the soul's history through corridors of light where the hours are suns, endless and singing, whose lovely ambition was that their lips, still touched with fire, should tell of the spirit clothed from head to foot in song, and who hoarded from the spring branches the desires falling across their bodies like blossoms. Near the snow, near the sun, in the highest field, see how these names are fated by the waving grass and by the streamers of white cloud and whispers of wind in the listening sky. The names of those who in their lives fought for life, who wore at their hearts the fire's center. Born of the sun, they traveled a short while towards the sun and left the vivid air signed with their honor."
But the greatness proposed by our Lord is of a kind totally unique and was sung long ago by the prophet Isaiah in the fourth song of the servant of Yahweh.
Of sorrows and familiar with suffering, a man to make people screen their faces. He was despised, and we took no account of him.
He was despised and rejected, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief.
Ours were the sufferings he bore, ours the sorrows he carried. He was pierced through for our faults, crushed for our sins. On him lies a punishment that brings us peace, and through his wounds we are healed. We had all gone astray like sheep, each taking his own way, and Yahweh burdened him with the sins of all of us. Yes, he was torn away from the land of the living, for our faults, struck down in death. Yahweh has been pleased to crush him with suffering. If he offers his life in atonement, he shall see his heirs. He shall have a long life, and through him what Yahweh wishes will be done. His soul's anguish over, he shall see the light and be content. By his sufferings shall my servant justify many, taking their faults on himself. He shall divide the spoil with the mighty, for surrendering himself to death and letting himself be taken for a sinner, while he was bearing the faults of many and praying all the time for sinners.
And warm thanks there go to Jill Bevilacqua for this program by the title of There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye. Meanwhile, time to join EWTN's Bureau Chief here in Rome, Joan Lewis, who brings us the Vatican Week in review. So, Joan, it's a beautiful day and you've walked into our studios here with a beautiful shell necklace, and it has a medal on it which is connected to something that's happening in the Vatican on Sunday.
Oh, this weekend, the canonization ceremony, we will have seven new saints, one of whom is Mary Ann Cope, a Franciscan nun who for 35 years lived in Hawaii. She's from actually Upper New York, raised near Utica, New York, joined the Franciscan nuns in Syracuse. That's where her shrine is and everything today. But she spent 35 years of her long life in Hawaii.
So that's where your necklace comes
and
from.
And my necklace is so, you wish
for
you had
our listeners,
video.
Yeah. For our listeners, it's yellow shells.
Yellow shells, and I found out they're like snail shells. And then the beautiful medal, which has the church on it, and then her image on
the
another
church in
side.
Hawaii.
I haven't taken it off since they gave it to me from Hawaii. And it's absolutely magnificent, and people who don't even know me stop and say, oh, what is that? You know, so anyway, very, very exciting event. And when you look at the lives of the people, the two I know best are the two Americans, if you will, I mean, associated with Upper New York, that's Mary Ann Cope, and the Mohawk Indian girl.
I'll get you to pronounce that.
Yes, Kateri Tekavita. And called the Lily of the Mohawk. She died at the tender age, actually, of 24. But two amazing ladies, very inspirational. Mary Ann's life I have studied much more, and I've been to Hawaii on two different occasions to do research on and visit the places associated with St. Damien and Mary Ann. And the visitors from Hawaii, because it's one very, very long trip, as you can imagine. It's like 10,000 miles or something. And the Hawaii group went first to Syracuse, New York, A, to kind of break up the trip, but more importantly, obviously, to visit Mary Ann's shrine. And then they came to Rome on Tuesday, were at the papal audience Wednesday, and they danced. There was a group of Hawaiian dancers who danced for the Holy Father, and an event Friday night at the Vatican Museums in their honor, dancing also. So they're very, very excited. And you know what is especially exciting to me? The fact that Mother Mary Ann and of course, St. Damien, Father Damien before her, took care of these victims of leprosy for 35 years. She for 5 in Honolulu and then for 30 on the peninsula of Kalaupapa, where the victims of leprosy were exiled. It was such a contagious disease. Obviously, we know a lot more today. It's not contagious. But this was one amazing lady, the other nuns that came with her, and she promised her sisters that they would never, ever get leprosy. Now, St. Damien did die of leprosy, but I have discovered in the intervening years of study, you have to have a genetic predisposition to get leprosy. And most of the people that lived there over the years were from China, the Philippines, Native Hawaiians, Samoans, They were generally, for example, not North Americans or Western Europeans. But today there are 17 who still live on the island. 9 of them are in Rome as we speak. They came for the beatification. They've lived there since like 1970, 69, 70, 71. One of them was my guide this summer, Melli. And so she's here in Rome. Again, they're not contagious at all. You don't so much see external signs. You wouldn't walk down the street and say, oh, my word, you know, they have leprosy. There's only one or two that there's a slight deformation, for example, of the hands that you can see. But to me, the more I studied Marianne, the more she was such a model, an inspiration, I guess you'd say, for the simple reason she did something I know very well that I could not have done. And I was talking about Father Damien when he was canonized in 2009. I was talking about him with the priest, and I said, I don't think I ever could have done that, the kind of work Mother Teresa did and so forth. Just being around these people, afraid that to touch them, but you'd have to minister to them. And I said to this priest, I just don't think I could have done that. And he said, Joan, remember that, he said, God gives people like that, many of the people who are the saints, canonized saints, he does give them extra grace and extra gifts, charisms, whatever we want to call it. And he said, they are given the extra gifts, but then they have to live up to it. So he said, you may not have the same gifts or grace as a Marianne, but God has given you your gifts, and he wants you to live up to that. And I found that enormously consoling, that I have to live heroic virtues in the sense of the gifts that God gave me. And it may not be like Marianne, but it's still very, very consoling.
Anyway, so, getting back to us here in the Vatican, Joan.
There is other news, believe it or not. And to kind of go back a bit, if we...
The Wednesday audience, perhaps?
A lot of big events, actually, yes, around Wednesday and Thursday. The Wednesday audience, the Pope announced that he was starting a new series of catecheses that will cover the entire period of the Year of Faith, which will end November of 2013. And he said that this year was meant to renew our enthusiasm for believing in Jesus Christ. And, of course, Jesus Christ is absolutely probably the key word at the synod for the new evangelization.
Which is also taking place in the Vatican.
Amazing. And as we speak, the synod fathers and other participants, experts and so forth, have gone into their language small group meetings now. The speeches that they gave in the synod hall, that part is over. Now they are digesting what has been said in the Synod Hall, discussing it in the language groups. The result of those talks will be propositions given to the Holy Father that he will then write his document, probably come out in a year or two, called the Apostolic Exhortation. But what's very interesting, the Pope's catechesis was so beautiful Wednesday. I will often on my blog give a summary, and I gave like the whole catechesis. It was almost like a prayer. And the Pope talked about the faith. He and the main thing today, which is so sad and disappointing, he said, people don't know the basics of their faith. There are some people who cannot even recite the creed. And actually, he said that is one of the most important things that we want to get into. And he said, we're living in a society that has profoundly changed, a society in flux. And he said, there's individualism and there's relativism. They dominate the hearts of so many people. And he said, they've also touched believers. This has gotten to believers, and that's why he said he wants to, in the Year of Faith, help people make this journey of faith and to deepen their faith. And he said, you know, the contents of our faith are directly related to our life's experience. So I am sure what we're going to have at the end of this year is a very beautiful book, a volume of all his magnificent, if there is half as beautiful as last Wednesday's, you know. And then, but this week there were a lot of other announcements that came out.
One, yes, connected to Syria, Joan.
Exactly. As a matter of fact, it was Tuesday afternoon that Cardinal Secretary of State Tarcisio Bertone announced the Holy Father will send a delegation to Damascus, Syria, to express in the Pope's name, that of the entire Church, the Synod Fathers, fraternal solidarity with the entire population, and to express the Pope's closeness to all the people of Syria, but especially to the Christian brothers and sisters. And it's very interesting. The delegation is composed of Synod Fathers representing all of the continents. So you have African Cardinal, you have Pasinha, you have Cardinal Dolan of New York, and Cardinal, but there is a Vietnamese bishop going, and Cardinal Jean-Louis Torrent, who's president here at the Vatican of the Pontifical Council for Interreligious Dialogue. So now the date has not been set. We learned in a press conference this week. They're still looking at that. There's formalities you have to do with the government, visas. I don't know what else is required, but they're working all that out, and it's very possible that in the week to come, the delegation may go there. And then another interesting announcement was made, but also for 2013, but very interesting. The Holy Father has decided to call all of the Holy See Apostolic Nuncios. People should know that that word means ambassador. The apostolic delegates and permanent observers to organizations like the UN and so forth. He's called them to Rome in June of 2013. For a meeting to reflect on the year of faith, because at that point it'll be like a little more than half over.
That's kind of an unusual meeting. Synods are regular meetings since Vatican II, but that's kind of an unusual meeting.
Exactly. And you've got, again, you're looking at the universal church with this too. The year of faith affects the universal church, the synod of bishops, the new evangelization. It involves us. You know, two of us sitting here in the studio, the people walking down the street today, it involves all of our Christian brothers and sisters, not just the Synod Fathers who are talking over these various issues. So when you have the nuncios come in, every single country, and I think it's like 174, 176 to in addition to organizations. The Apostolic Nuncios in, oh my word, so as I said, 174 countries. So they'll all be here and they're going to have this very wonderful tapestry or mosaic of the Universal Church and what each church is doing. You know.
Thank you very much, Joan. See you next
week. Yeah, indeed.
And many thanks there go to Joan Lewis, EWTN's Bureau Chief here in Rome. And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening. Don't forget, we'll be back again at the same time tomorrow, so be sure to join us then. You've been listening to the English programme of Vatican Radio. Laudetur Jesus Christus.